this way.
So the reason why I played that, in addition to annoying Jeremy, no doubt, to no end, is because basically, to revisit the history that these three lectures are going to cover, that is essentially the rise of bourgeois society in Western Europe and its subsequent spread across the globe, is essentially to beg the question of historical meaning. And what I find so interesting about this clip from the Marie Antoinette film, from Sofia Coppola's Marie Antoinette, is you essentially have these old regime actors, Louis XVI and his wife Marie Antoinette, who essentially are products, functionaries, tools of the absolutist state machinery of the Ancien Regime. And they fulfill their roles. They're constantly contorted and bent each way possible into playing those roles, and to make sure they continue to play them, to live a life of conspicuous consumption, of displaying their nobility, their majesty, their divinity. And there are all these hints, some more oblique than others throughout the film, that that world of social practices and institutions is slowly being worn away, and that something new is replacing it. And essentially, you have them sitting here, having been swept up in this tide of history, and this transformation of institutions and practices beyond their back, such that they've gone from being people fulfilling their role in the absolute state machinery, in the aristocracy, priestcraft, and monarchy of the old regime, to essentially parasites, hangers-on, despots in the new order of things, and its history is swept over them. And this befuddled and scared look they have, right, is, well, let me concentrate on this befuddled look. This befuddled look they have very much raises the question of what happened. How did we go from the old regime to this new world? But I think if you're going to ask this question, the kind of bewilderment on their faces also means something else this late in history of the year 2011, which is, given the fact, with the failures of 1848 and with the failures of 1917 and with the subsequent decline and decay of the left and the complete eclipse of a social politics of revolutionary emancipation, the question is begged, what's this all about? Right? Their look of bewilderment is essentially 1789, the French Revolution begins this modern history of radical people in every aspect of social and political life. But now, living in the postmodern epoch of the early 21st century, we're thrust, as it were, back on the history to ask the question, what was this all about? So we can look at the Jason Schwartzman and the Kirsten Dunst characters with their bewilderment and genuinely imagine, given the fact that we live in a postmodern age, that all revolutions have been defeated and wrapped up, that we are the last men at the end of history, that this history all sort of looks meaningless and peculiar, and it sort of befuddles us, it bewilders us. And so I just feel that this scene not only is a great, powerful demonstration of the way old regime actors would have felt the loss of their social world as out of the clear blue sky, but also because it sort of begs to us, the audience, what was this all about? Why did these people have to be tyrannized by yeoman farmers and urban plebeians, and then their heads cut off? And all of the blood and revolution and war and social politics and revolutionary people that followed for the next 200 years, did it have any meaning whatsoever? And I really think that a serious question we have to ask ourselves in 2011 is there a way in which we can look back on the old regime, its collapse in 1789, as a kind of unnecessary puzzle, right? Why did it all happen? What's the point, right? We're at the end of history. Wasn't this history all just an accident? Wasn't this totally unnecessary? And so the next three lectures are essentially an attempt to try and argue a vision of the past or of history from essentially the Neolithic Revolution through to 1848, and to try and give that history some sort of meaning. Meaning for the future, if not for the present. Okay? And I just want to read you one quote by the Abbé Renal. He was a French philosopher, a radical philosopher, friends of those who put together the encyclopedia. And he writes this in the 1776 edition of his A Philosophical and Political History of the Settlements and Trade of Europeans in the East and West Indies. Renal speaks, quote, of a revolution in the commerce and in the power of nations and in the manners, industry, and government of the world in general. He's talking about the previous 200 to 300 years of European and indeed global history. Again, in his words, at this period, new connections were formed by the most distant regions for the supply of wants they had never before experienced. A general intercourse of opinions, laws, and customs, diseases and remedies, virtues and vices, was established throughout the world. Everything has changed and must change again. But it is a question whether the revolutions that are past or those which must hereafter take place have been or can be of any utility to the human race. Will they ever add to the tranquility, the happiness, and the pleasures of mankind? Can they improve our present state, or do they only change it? And I think Renaud's question is really central. Looking back at this history, was there any point to all of this? What did all of this essentially mean? Were these simply unnecessary hiccups and roadblocks and catastrophes on the way to the evolutionary unfolding of liberal democracy? Or were these, was everything that motivated the French Revolution and the subsequent upheavals simply a prelude to every 20th century totalitarianism? And I think that's a meaningful question that we have to keep open in Platypus and more generally on the Marxist left. But what I'm going to attempt to do in the next three lectures is to lay out basically an outline of the history of the period leading very broadly up to 1848 in an attempt to argue that this could possibly have some meaning for the future. But now, that being said, let me just move more into the lecture proper. Essentially, even though today's lecture ends with the year 1750, I'm really going to end at the beginning of the 18th century. In other words, I'm going to take you up to the 18th century today and basically give you a very vague outline up to 1750. And then in the next lecture, which is really the crucial lecture, lecture 2 from 1750 to 1815, I'm going to begin in the early 18th century just to give you a richer picture of the 18th century. All right? But 1750 is a key point not only because it's on the eve of Rousseau writing the first and second discourse on the social contract. It's also at the height of Anglo-French global rivalry. The two great European world powers are at that moment in a brief peace in between two great wars where they're struggling for colonies and markets across the world. It's also the moment where the Enlightenment has a very radical turn, and that's signified by Rousseau's second discourse and social contract, where the Enlightenment that had been boiling up with the scientific revolution and the discoveries and the political movements of the 17th and early 18th century has a quite decisive radical break. And last but not least, it's also obviously the eve of the American and French revolutions and the upheavals that sweep across Latin America in the wake of the American Revolution and the 1830 July Revolution in France and the 1848 revolutions across Europe. So that's why 1750 is a marker. Anglo-French global rivalry is at its apex. No one is quite certain who's going to become the great power of the world in 1750. By 1760, it's pretty much clear to a lot of observers that it will be Britain. But at 1750, no one knows. They genuinely are the first two rival powers whose geopolitical combat involves populations across the globe and affects the lives of people that live everywhere in the world. Not just the West Indies and North America, but also South America, South Asia, East Asia, Western Africa, Central and Eastern Europe. Okay? The Enlightenment has been getting off the ground since about the 1670s. It's going to enter into a radical phase with Rousseau and the subsequent trajectory to Adam Smith, Immanuel Kant, and Hegel in the second half of the 18th century. And the bourgeois revolutions, the kind of classic bourgeois revolution, the great French Revolution of 1789, were on the eve of that in 1750. It's kind of the height of the French old regime. So that's why it's a marker. And so I'm going to take you very vaguely up to 1750 today, but then next time I'm going to start again before 1750 and kind of give a richer picture. Since I'm dealing with centuries of history today, I'm painting at very broad brushstrokes. And since next time I'm only dealing about 65 years of history, I'll try and get more finer detail and more accurate about the trend. But really, finally, these three lectures are not really meant to be, here's the history of this. It's simply, you're reading these radical bourgeois philosophers. You're presumably interested in Platypus or already involved in Platypus. And so these three lectures are really just meant to sort of be venues of a historical sensibility. They're not really meant to say, here's an accurate and complete and total picture of this period, or here's the most meaningful way you can construe the processes and events of this period. Rather, they're simply to try and just give a sensibility of what are some major events and processes and transformations, kind of give you signposts on the way of thinking about, obviously, politics and society in the very, very, very broad strokes. Okay? So again, it's not that I'm going to be inaccurate. It's simply the case that I'm very much going to be just trying to outline a historical sensibility and not really give you the history of the world before 1750 or the history of the world in between 1750 and 1848. I think that would be preposterous and absurd. I'm not qualified to do it. You couldn't do it in the time that's offered. So take this for what it is. It's a sensibility. It's just meant to give you some idea of dates, processes of some importance. And I really would have to say that any specific thing I talk about in here would probably horrify experts in that specific subject. All right? But where I sort of would take my stand is totality. That is to say that overall, there's an overall picture here that is more than the sum of its parts, despite the kind of probably a great deal of grayness that I paint events and processes such as the Renaissance or the American Revolution or the Protestant Reformation with. Okay? So that being said, I just wanted to get all of that out as a kind of general portray. All right?
To summarize Bruce in 30 seconds.
So, Eugene, do you have a question?
Well, just, you began with this kind of end of history notion and sort of postmodern sense of does this have. Are these questions that Platypus is actively debating and considering as part of the overall synthesis that it's called?
I wouldn't say it's the question of whether or not the old regime's populace had a point, and all of the subsequent history that's still unfolding to today that comes out of that point. In that very broad sense, yes, those are questions we're still dealing with, although, you know, obviously not too focused on whether or not the topic of the old regime had a point. It's more about the subsequent historical trajectory that the French Revolution lets loose, right, as a whole. But I just think that imagery of them sitting there kind of puzzled and uncertain what's going on is also something that really should reflect back on us, that we're uncertain if this event should have happened. But what did it mean that it happened?
Well, also, I would say some of part of this is kind of an inversion of Fukuyama. I mean, Fukuyama's a kind of degenerate Hegelian. He thinks that in his original version, Soviet history ended with the end of the Soviet Union. I mean, for Platypus, insofar as Platypus is left centric, for us, the problem is the problem wasn't the left. So the extent of reconstructing the idea of reconstructing the left as a project, obviously that would imply a complete rejection of the idea of the end of history. The left has any kind of future or possibility. The project of human emancipation has a future, then obviously history hasn't ended. It's just taken a really bad long term.
So I just want to briefly, and I'm going to sketch this out in more detail, but just outline the very broad strokes of the history. Essentially, 10,000 years ago, you have the Neolithic Revolution. Very broadly, the shift from nomadic hunter-gatherer societies to settled agriculture. Right? Retrospectively, we can look at this as the rise of class society. That is, a vast majority of the population involved in direct production, largely agricultural, providing a surplus, that is, an amount of goods and services beyond what they need for their subsistence, to an exploiting or lordly class that does not work the land or engage in social or material reproduction. I'm going to cover these grounds in more detail later, but within that period you would include Periclean Athens, the ancient Roman Republican Empire, the European Dark Ages, the High Middle Ages. But what's sort of really important for me is most of the planet is either nomadic hunter-gatherer societies or settled agricultural civilizations up until about 1300 of the Common Era, or AD, whichever you prefer. In between 1300 and 1600, the variance of settled agricultural life in Western Europe goes into a profound crisis over a period of about 300 years, which I label the breakdown of medieval civilization, which lasts roughly from 1320 to 1480 CE, and the rise of the commodity form of labor, which I date approximately to 1450 to 1600 CE. This is a profound crisis in settled agricultural life in Western Europe, sometimes referred to as feudalism. And in the midst of this breakdown, a new form of society based on the social mediation of the commodity form of labor begins to come into being. But that should not be mistaken for bourgeois society. That is, this period of the breakdown of medieval civilization is certainly not bourgeois society, and the rise of the commodity form of labor is not bourgeois society. The rise of the commodity form of labor is a precondition of bourgeois society, but it's only generalized and universalized with the actual emergence and consolidation of bourgeois society. So you have the simmering up, the boiling up of the commodity form of labor. But bourgeois society itself does not fully emerge, is not fully brought into being until the bourgeois revolutionary epoch, which I would date roughly from 1600 to 1848 CE, which I labeled here the emergence of bourgeois society, bourgeois revolutions as the political constitution of capital. Again, between 1450 and 1600, you begin to see the commodity form of labor rise as a fundamental background of social organization. You see the erosion of caste and custom-based forms of social organization. But it is not until the bourgeois revolutionary epoch, stretching roughly from the middle of the Dutch Revolt in 1600 through to the European Revolutions of 1848, that you have the emergence of bourgeois society with the political consolidation of capital in the great bourgeois revolutions. I include in that the Dutch Revolt stretching from 1568 to 1648, the English Civil Wars and Commonwealth stretching from 1640 to 1660, the English Glorious Revolution of 1688-1689, the American Revolution of 1775 to 1783, the French Revolution of 1789 to 1815, and then, to a lesser degree important or a lesser degree transformative, the July Monarchy Revolution of France of 1830, and then the European, the first outbreaks of the European Revolutions of 1848. But what's key is the European Revolutions of 1848 are Janus-based. They are at one time the last of the classical bourgeois revolutions, the last of the period of the political constitution of modern industrial capital. But they also the first of the proletarian socialist revolutions based on the social democratic workers' movement, principally in Paris. And that's why 1848 marks a profound shift. And we have a shift from the emergence of bourgeois society in between 1600 and 1848 to the crisis of bourgeois society, which lasts from 1848 till today. The crisis of bourgeois society, which I've labeled here post-1848 CE, is the crisis of bourgeois society, the proletarianization of the world. And that remains with us. So the period 1600 to 1848 is the period of the emergence of bourgeois society, the political constitution of modern capitalism, and post-1848 is the period of the crisis of bourgeois society, the proletarianization of the world. Although, as I say here next to post-1848, many of the features of the crisis, many prophecies regarding the crisis bourgeois society will enter into, are published and discussed long before 1848. In fact, I would say that with Rousseau, and especially with several of the authors we're going to engage with, Kant, Comte, Adam Smith, Hegel, we're already trying to grasp bourgeois society, and potentially many people see the features of its coming crisis. Okay? So even though the full crisis of bourgeois society is really a post-1848 phenomenon, there are anticipations of it not only in thought before 1848, but also in terms of politics, such as the rise and incredible failure of the Chartist movement in England, the disaster of the utopian socialist experiments in the 1820s and 30s, and the failure of the radical Jacobin left in between 1792 and 1794. Those are just a few of the political manifestations. Okay? So that's the broad schema that I would paint. Rise of traditional agrarian civilization, beginning of its breakdown, perhaps being replaced by something else. That's something else, the commodity form of labor providing the precondition for the bourgeois revolutions, which in turn generalize, universalize, and fully consolidate the commodity form of labor, that is bourgeois society. And that form of society, which I would argue produces some of the most just, prosperous, and emancipated forms of human community the world has ever seen, goes into crisis in the first half of the 19th century, and we remain in that crisis until this day. Now, that all being said, I know we're 15 minutes behind, but I thought this would be a good moment to stop, just because that's a broad schema, and now the rest of this lecture is essentially going to go somewheres to about between 1700 and 1750, filling this picture in.
And maybe this is something you will cover, but I would be very interested to talk about the character of the commodity form pre- the moment before it's constituting itself as bourgeois society, meaning what are the characteristics and what way does one understand the commodity form?
I will get into that. I'll give you a kind of answer now and go into detail. I think only retrospectively do you understand it as the preconditions of the generalization of commodity form of labor. It's certainly not the case that before the bourgeois revolutions and before the full emergence of bourgeois society, could you meaningfully speak of the commodity form of labor as the fundamental form of mediation between individuals? That being said, what we can say retrospectively is that the breakdown of traditional society, right, this period, the breakdown of traditional society had to occur to open up the space for the bourgeois revolutions that consolidate capitalism. So I would just say retrospectively, we can see elements of the crisis of traditional agrarian society that will later be fully consolidated as the commodity form of labor. But I definitely will get into that more detail. I'm sorry, I forgot your name.
Mike. Is the reason that you can't talk about the commodity form of labor before 1600 because it needed land reform in order?
That's something I would get. Can I address that as it comes up? Because I will get into further details. The main reason being is there are all sorts of things like the extension of the world market, the rise of cities, that clearly ultimately provide a backdrop to the rise of the commodity form of labor. But it's not until the political constitution of bourgeois society in the bourgeois revolutionary epoch that that becomes generalized. It becomes the fundamental form of organizing social political life, if that makes sense. Right? But we can see retrospectively things that are necessary preconditions for it. The other way to think about this is, Marx says this in the Gründer side, you probably needed to divorce peasants from the land to get bourgeois society. But that being said, bourgeois society is not reducible to constantly divorcing peasants from the land. Meaning, this period is not about saying we have bourgeois society. Rather, it's about saying we have a crisis of traditional agrarian society, which has been relatively stable for 10,000 years. And that crisis is a necessary precondition for everything that follows after. Although everything that follows after is in no way the same as or reducible to that crisis. In fact, I would say, once you have the bourgeois revolutions and you have the political constitution of capital, history is on a totally different train line, so to speak, that makes it completely, that makes it a radical break from all previous forms of human community, both settled agriculturalists and nomadic hunter-gatherer. Can I take sort of Richard, do you mind if I take Mike?
Just one more thing as I'm trying to reduce things. Would the crisis be synonymous with the organic composition of capital? Is that something that Platypus accepts?
The crisis of traditional society?
Yeah.
No, I would not say that.
So like crisis theory.
This is by crisis. I'm not talking about value crises within capitalism. I'm talking about the breakdown of traditional agrarian society,
right.
Pre-modern social.
But how are they sometimes the same or different?
I would say they're radically different. Radically different. Just a quick example, because we do have to move on. For example, right? Almost all pre-modern socioeconomic crises are premised on, if you'll forgive the crudity, too little. Starvation, harvest failure, Malthusian crisis, etc., etc. Whereas overproduction, if you forgive the crudity, too much, is the fundamental feature of socioeconomic crisis within the modern history of capital. So that being said, that's how I would separate them. But I honestly did not mean any sort of rigorous Marxian category by the term crisis here. I meant it simply as the breakdown of the traditional agrarian society. Okay? I'm going to quickly cover some things and we'll do the pizza, because this is the part where I'm going to make up a lot of ground. Okay, everybody basically gets this. I wanted to give each of these guys 5 minutes. That's not going to be possible, so I'm going to give them each about a minute. Ancient Greece is the only reason why I mention ancient Greece and Rome is because at the dawn of the modern bourgeois epoch, there is a generalized understanding of itself as a return to classical antiquity. So one always has to kind of navigate the idea that the dawn of a radical break in human history is marked by the actors at the time as a recovery of the classical past. Needless to say, ancient Greece and ancient Rome are part of settled agricultural life, are fundamentally different forms of social organization, largely based on slavery, particularly in ancient Greece. The male heads of household go out to participate in political life, where women, children, and slaves remain in the dark and unspoken realm of the oikos of material and human reproduction. One could go on forever about ancient Rome. All that simply needs to be said is this. When the Western Roman Empire falls, okay, when the Western Roman Empire falls, essentially, no world empire is reconstituted in its place. What do I mean by this? What I mean is, if you look around the world in areas of settled agricultural civilization, there is no comparable period of the absence of a world empire. In the long, well-established agricultural civilizations, there is no comparable period of the absence of a great world empire in comparison to the European Dark Ages and Middle Ages. That is to say, after the fall of the Western Roman Empire, From during the European Dark Ages and the High Middle Ages, there is no great world empire that oversees settled agricultural life within Western Europe. That is a very, very long period, virtually unmatched anywhere. And that's really, really important. It makes Western Europe, especially in the period of European Dark Ages, a profoundly backward society. In terms of traditional agrarian life, one could go around the planet in the year 900 CE, and you would really think, especially Northwestern Europe, as a very barbaric place, with low rates of literacy, not a serious level of civilization, no division of labor, little interconnectedness between social places, okay? And no serious great agrarian empire, as the Western Roman Empire was, overseeing and managing the social and political order. And so there's a profound absence of any kind of world empire during the European Dark Ages and the High Middle Ages. Now, what begins to be important, I'm sorry that I had to skip over Greece and Rome and all of this kind of stuff so quickly, but what begins to be important is after the Germanic invasions during the European Dark Ages, there are attempts to reconstitute a world empire on a scale equivalent to the former Western Roman Empire. Most famous, I'm sure many of you have heard of Charlemagne. But his empire, although quickly patched together and quite vast in extent, completely falls apart upon his death. And almost immediately afterwards, several of his leading nobility, several of his leading chieftains, who are essentially his cavalry officers, right, begin to take over sections of his former domains. So what you see quickly, so in other words, we're in the European Dark Ages, there's a constant effort to kind of renew or recreate a Western Roman Empire. Charlemagne is the most serious attempt at this. It's a spectacular failure. It crumbles relatively quickly within his death, and his cavalry lieutenants essentially claim dominion over people and land within his former empire and break it up amongst themselves. And essentially, feudalism, the social form of organization that dominated Europe in the latter Dark Ages and during the High Middle Ages, is premised on these cavalry lords essentially becoming the master of territories and men and women in given places that were formerly part of this great empire that tried to recreate the Western Roman Empire. All right? And that feudalism essentially is initially extremely backwards, but slowly over time, as these cavalry lords settle down, as they build great castles and manorial estates, as a kind of period of warfare, of warlordism, gives way to a period of boundary demarcation and stability, you see slow upticks in agricultural output. It's essentially because a highly stable form of cereal cultivation has been implemented. And you see between roughly the year 1000 and 1200 a slow growth in agricultural productivity that allows for a stable cereal-based civilization to come into being in Western Europe. This gives rise by the 12th century to a new flourishing of culture and the arts and literature, often referred to as the High Middle Ages. All right? So I'm going to stop there because we'll have pizza now, but think of Europe in between the years 12 and 1300. People often refer to this as the First European Renaissance, the First European Revolution, a settled, cereal-producing civilization with a decent degree of agricultural output has come into being and is allowing for some degrees of cities to form off the land. And you have a real flourishing of the arts, of culture, of religion, of various forms of intellectual and political activity. And we'll stop here in the year 1300, which is the eve of the great crisis and breakdown, and grab a pizza. Can everybody just grab a pizza and then can we go back? Because I don't want to keep people here all night.
Okay, I need to show of hands.
Can we pause the recording?
Yeah, pause the recording. And I need to show of hands of who's going to have so I can calculate how much money you need. So, hands up if you're going to take 1, 2, 3, 4,
maybe,
5,
maybe.
6,
maybe.
Myself 7.
1450 to 1600. Retrospectively, we can see that certain preconditions for the bourgeois revolutionary epoch came into being. Okay? And two of those preconditions are, I just talked about, were imperceptible to people. That is the proletarianization, the doubly free form of wage labor emerging across large zones of northwestern Europe on one hand, And also, the increasing centralization of the aristocracy into monarchical households and monarchical states. Okay, these are essentially the long roads to the social form of wage labor and the centralized territorial state, both of which we can see are keys to the emergence of bourgeois society. That being said, I want to now talk about, basically in about the middle of the 15th century, okay, so the crisis is slowly being given way. You decimate enough the population, enough peasants revolt, all of this happens. You essentially have the conditions where you can begin to restore stability. That is to say, there's plenty of land available in many sections of Europe. Now, old, better agrarian zones can be farmed by fewer people. You're not worried about expanding further and colonizing deeper, et cetera, et cetera. I sort of have to move very quickly, but the point of all of this is by about the middle of the 15th century, you get a recovery. Now, that being said, even though you get a recovery, one shouldn't think of the recovery as simply the restoration of the world as it was in 1320. Medieval civilization has been deeply racked by this. Many medieval historians talk about the 15th century as a period of the absolute collapse of medieval civilization and a total crisis of the medieval worldview. And that more or less continues. All right? And by the end of the 15th century, the early 16th century, you have three developments which are essentially, in many ways, the final collapse of medieval civilization and a kind of, Hegel put it, a kind of rosy dawn of the bourgeois epoch. Now, that being said, we are not yet in the bourgeois epoch. It's more like the Hegel's exact quote for this is, if you don't mind me, Hegel's exact quote for this is, these events may be compared with that blush of dawn, which after long storms first betokens the return of a bright and glorious day. This day is the day of universality, which breaks upon the world after the long, eventful, and terrible night of the Middle Ages. A day which is distinguished by science, art, and inventive impulse. So this being said, this is the period that I want to call, this period roughly 1450 to 1650, the rise of the commodity form of labor, the dawn. It is not bourgeois society, but it's the first rays that are sort of going to open up into the bright noon of bourgeois society, the first morning rays. Now, it's principally characterized by three things, all of which involve the discovery of a world previously unknown to Western Europeans. The first is literally the discovery of two physical new worlds. That is, well, the discovery of one physical new world, North and South America. The second is the discovery of an old world, the Renaissance, the recovery of classical antiquity, particularly ancient Greece, which I'll get to in a moment. And the third is the discovery of an internal new world. That is the spiritual inner subjectivity of the Protestant Reformation. So essentially, as medieval civilization is going through this crisis, it's beginning to recover, but it's still very much dealing with the breakdown of every form of high medieval life, you essentially begin to see three developments which open up new vistas, new worlds. The Protestant Reformation and the internal world of spiritual subjectivity, the Renaissance and the recapturing of the old world of classical antiquity, and the discovery of the new world, the Americas. Now, each of these things, and this is vital, each of these things retrospectively opens up the path for the later emergence of bourgeois society. But that being said, they come out of the crisis of medieval civilization. And their followers, their key actors, all understand themselves being trying, in some sense, to bring stability to a way of life that's going out of the world. So let me give you just three examples to kind of confirm this. Christopher Columbus does not travel to the New World as a beacon of science and exploration. Christopher Columbus's main goal is to set up diplomatic relations with the Great Khan, the great non-Muslim prince in the Far East within the 15th century European imagination. And together, together through diplomatic alliances and through the Great Khan providing gold and silver and other such resources to Columbus, launching a new crusade against Islam. That is Christopher Columbus's primary motivation in sailing west, is to launch a crusade against Islam and to recover the now almost impossibly distant Holy Lands. Two, the Renaissance does not understand itself as the birth of a new world. It understands itself as the recovery of the ancient Greek and Roman past. Machiavelli famously says that there can be no higher form of life. All we can hope to do is recover what was once achieved by the ancients. So again, it appears to be the breakout into something new, but it has to be understood as informed by a consciousness of wanting to save or recover the old. And finally, the Protestant Reformation. Luther does not set about to create a new form of Christianity, much less religious pluralism or religious toleration. Rather, he seeks to restore primitive Christianity and smash what he sees as the corruption of the medieval Roman Catholic Church. And furthermore, he does so because of the crisis of late medieval civilization. He comes out of an entire background of the Hussites, various other heresies, which are essentially in the midst of this crisis, critiquing the Catholic Church, critiquing its inadequacy of the present. And Luther comes out of that moment because people are facing deep epistemological anxieties. If you look at Western Europe in between roughly 1450 and 1520, many, many writers obsessed with the idea that they're not certain about their salvation. They don't know, have I gone on enough pilgrimages? Have I given enough money? Have I donated enough to the church? Have I been blessed by enough saints? People have deep epistemological anxiety over whether or not they're being saved. And Luther's the attempt in his understanding to restore a pure Pauline Christianity of faith and to talk about the certainty of salvation and to overcome this deep epistemological anxiety being generated by the breakdown of late medieval civilization. But all three of them, Luther, the Protestant Reformation, all three of them imagine themselves not embarking on the new, but trying to save the old. Luther, the return to primitive Christianity, Columbus, the launching of a great medieval crusade, and Petrarch, through Erasmus, the recovery of the classical past. That's what all of them understand, and all of them, for reasons I can't go into detail, are very broadly motivated by what they see as the complete collapse of medieval European civilization. Okay, and I know guys are going to kill me because I probably will be. So, this all being said, let me just go very quickly through some things. The Renaissance, of course, the Roman Catholic Church had preserved many Latinate texts. Much was known throughout the medieval world about ancient Roman civilization. However, what's really new in the Renaissance is after the fall of Byzantium, the heir of the Eastern Roman Empire, in 1453, many Greek language scholars traveled to the West and set up shop in Florence, Milan, and other, essentially, Italianate city-states. And they bring with them a Greek Renaissance. And the texts of Plato and Aristotle, Xenophon, and others were really not very well known. I mean, Aquinas, through the medieval Islamic tradition, had access to Aristotle. But the kind of mass intellectual access to the ancient Greek world is provided with the fall of Byzantium to the Ottomans in 1453. And so that is a recovery of not simply the Roman past, which had sort of been there and not deeply explored throughout the Middle Ages. It is actually the discovery of the ancient Greek past, added on to the recovery of the Roman past. This brings about new forms of textualism and new forms of critical analysis of texts that are vital. The discovery of the New World, although I focused on Columbus, it's really important to realize the discovery of the New World is really not simply about the Americas. It's also about the discovery of a passage around the southern tip of Africa to the East Indies. Throughout the medieval period, access to what is now what we now refer to as Eastern Africa, South Asia, Southeast Asia, and East Asia was largely limited to land routes and the Mediterranean, and mediated by the Italian city-states. The Portuguese and then the Dutch set about on explorations and eventually round the Cape of Good Hope, the southern tip of Africa, in the 15th century. It's one of the things that gets the African slave trade started off on the West Coast. But discover a direct passage to the East Indies, completely circumventing the Italian city-states. So when I talk about this, sorry, Richard?
And circumventing the Muslims.
And circumventing the Muslims. The land, the Muslim-controlled land routes. Okay? That being said, so discovering the New World is really a discovery of a direct maritime passage to a very old world, that of Asia. And the New World, the Americas. It's both. And that is what both the Abbe Rinald and Adam Smith famously referred to as the two greatest discoveries in the history of humanity. Right? The passage around the Cape of Good Hope, the opening of Asia to direct maritime access to Europeans, and the discovery of the New Worlds. Now, that being said, you have to imagine those discoveries open up an incredible amount of markets and populations to the trade and production of Western Europe, right? And even though trade can't bring about a transformation in a mode of production in and of itself, one could not account for the rise of bourgeois society in the absence of the massive stimulus to market, trade, and production that is brought about through the discovery of the New World and the discovery of a direct maritime passage to Asia. Those are absolutely crucial. But again, much like the Renaissance, embarked on the recovery of the classical past and created all these new forms of textuality and criticism. The discovery of the New World was meant to launch this old crusade, but opens up and reinforces the disintegrative tendencies in the breakdown of medieval civilization. In other words, you have some degree of, with the proletarianization of vast zones of northwestern Europe in the 14th and 15th century, you have the growth of increasing social interdependency between people. As this social interdependency grows, commodity production and exchange grows. Columbus may have set off to launch a crusade, but in creating this vast global interconnectivity, he reinforced this emergent commodity form of labor that was dissolving traditional agrarian life, however unintentionally. Now, finally, it has to be said that the Protestant Reformation largely spreads due to two reasons. One, it spreads in the emerging commercial city centers and emerging manufacturing city centers because the old parish structure of the Catholic Church it was based on a more rural agrarian society, cannot adequately respond to a lot of urban heresies of the 15th and 16th century. But it also spreads because of the printing press, which, as Hegel famously said, the printing press for the first time allows men to have ideal relations with one another. Relations of pure ideas between people, right? Which the printing press allows for. And essentially, the printing press, the combination of the new commercial and manufacturing cities, the combination of the growth of social interdependency through the rise of zones of proletarianization, and the combination of the printing press are the fuel that ignites the Protestant Reformation. That being said, what's vital to realize is it's not really this old story of a Catholic medieval Europe that simply doesn't respond is not true. The actual first embers of the Protestant Reformation come from reforming Catholic humanists within the medieval church. That is, it's figures like Erasmus and Thomas More that are the most radical and experimental reformers of the early 16th century. They correspond with Luther. They're very happy with his critique of the church. But ultimately, they think he goes a bridge too far in his declaration of simply religious truth can be arrived at through consciousness interacting with the Bible directly. No clerical intermediary is necessary. Erasmus and Thomas More, these Catholic humanist reformers, who have been advocates of transforming the medieval structure of the church and introducing many of Luther and early Protestant reforms, essentially draw back at this. They think it's a bridge too far. Luther can be summarized as a direct attack on the caste system. The tripartite caste system of medieval Europe. Those who work, those who pray, those who fight. Those who pray are being assaulted. A separate clerical caste apart. A separate race of men that are the necessary intermediaries between conscience and God are being directly assaulted by Luther. He's saying everyone is the priesthood of all believers. All right? That's important to realize. But what's key here is Luther is not advocating religious toleration. Luther is saying that people should come to a knowledge of God and salvation and faith through a direct interaction with the Bible. But nevertheless, Luther himself believes there's only one possible conclusion to that direct interaction with the Bible. This is not religious toleration. Luther is not in the pantheon of proto-liberalism. All right? This is a guy whose critique of the Catholic Church and his assault on the clerical caste is to make way for what he thinks is the one true primitive Christianity he's restoring. And he's as prepared to put to the sword any Protestant reformers who don't come to his conclusion as he is Catholic priests. And that's really vital to realize. He doesn't think he's creating religious pluralism. He thinks he's restoring truth, and he's prepared to dump in a lake of fire everybody who doesn't come to the conclusions that he does through the direct reading of the Bible in Latin and later in vernacular German.
Which he translates.
That's really key to understand. Luther thinks he's getting at the truth, and everyone who doesn't get at that same truth is a heathen, is not saved, is not a proper Christian.
That's its intense antisemitism.
Absolutely.
And he also defends the ruling class of Germany against the rebellious peasants.
Right, and he
should be mowed down.
He's a propagandist against the radical Reformation, all of these kinds of things. The discovery of these new worlds of internal spiritual subjectivity, of the Americas, of the ancient classical past, they're rather motivated deeply by attempts to recover the past in the midst of the crisis of the present. They are not motivated by self-conscious bourgeois impulses. They're not motivated by some self-conscious impulse or interest to bring into being bourgeois society. But nevertheless, right, by launching a frontal assault on the priestly caste, by claiming that individual conscience can come to knowledge of God and salvation through a direct reading of the Bible, by recovering the ancient past, which appeals to many people in the urban centers of late 15th and 16th century Europe, because the Greco-Roman world was a much more urbanized and commercialized world than the medieval world. By recovering these things, by setting up new standards of textuality, by encouraging the creation of vernacular literature to be spread amongst urban middling sort, by discovering new worlds to launch crusades, but nevertheless discovering new worlds that give a great boost to emerging commodity production exchange, what happens is this attempt over time to sort of secure the present by recovering some aspect of the past ends up reinforcing the dissolving effect of the breakdown of agrarian civilization, of the crisis of medieval Europe. Okay? That being said, what essentially happens in the 16th century is that religious wars break out between Catholics and Protestants. The Catholic Church reforms a great deal. In fact, historians would no longer talk about a Protestant Reformation versus a Catholic Counter-Reformation, but rather two Reformations. But what we see happen in the 16th century is this process, right? These two imperceptible processes, that is the rise of the centralized state, of the absolutist monarchy, and the expansion of the wage labor form of social life. These two things now become mixed with these competing religious universalisms, this struggle between Protestant and Catholic faiths, right, which both claim to be universal truths. And what happens over the course of the 16th century is the tendency to create centralized absolutist states becomes intermingled with the tendency to go on Protestant crusades against Catholic countries and to go on Catholic crusades against Protestant countries. And you see the vast expansion of centralized state power. That is, in the midst of these 16th century religious wars, monarchies like the Valois and the Habsburgs grow in strength. Because you need greater armies, greater fiscal resources, more centralizations of resources and information in order to be able to fight these great religious wars. So this impulse that had been emerging in the 14th and 15th century towards Lord centralizing an absolute state is reinforced in this period of religious wars. And what essentially happens is by the late 16th and early 17th century, Europe is beginning to look like a series of old regime absolute monarchies in which most local aristocracies have been smashed or integrated in the centralized state. And in place of their local privileges, they now have positions in the court of great divine monarchs or sun kings. Now, what happens essentially is, to sort of wrap this up, you essentially get, and with that, you get massive fiscal and military revolutions. That is, as you have the rise of these centralized absolutist monarchies, you have the rise of standing armies, because you need a nearly permanent military staff to fight all the wars. You need an entire administrative and bureaucratic structure to be able to provision and provide materiel for those standing armies, right? So these things mix up. The tendency towards creating larger states and then going on Catholic and then fighting Catholic and Protestant religious wars in the 16th century drive a process of further state centralization such that much of Central and Western Europe looks dominated by the latter 16th century by old regime, what are going to be old regime absolutist monarchies. The most famous two represented being the Valois and the Habsburgs. Now that being said, the goal of recreating a Western Roman Empire is never abandoned. In fact, the greatest of these emerging royal absolutisms, the Habsburgs, attempt to carry out the reunification of the Western Roman Empire in the second half of the 16th century. Essentially, Charles V, who is the greatest Habsburg, is the greatest member of the Habsburg line. He essentially, you have to think, controls much of the New World, much of what is today Central and South America. He controls all of Habsburg Austria, much of the Holy Roman Empire, much of the Iberian Peninsula, much of northern Italy, much of what is today the Lowlands, Belgium, Netherlands, former Duchy of Burgundy, right? He controls much of what is known as the European Atlantic worlds. And so in the 16th century, he sets upon a project that, in other words, these emerging absolutist states don't have the idea in their head of abandoning this project of universal monarchy. He attempts to consolidate a universal world monarchy, which will be about his sole dominion and the spread of Roman Catholicism to all of his lands. That ultimately fails. And in light of that failure, he splits up his territories between two lines, the Austrian Habsburgs and the Spanish Habsburgs. And his son, Philip II, inherits the Spanish Habsburgs, but ultimately still attempts this effort to create a universal monarchy. One aspect of it you probably all know is he launches the Spanish Armada against England to reconvert the Protestant heathens of England, of Elizabeth's England, to the Holy Roman Church, and also to bring England under Spanish dominion. It's part of his larger project of trying to reignite his father's failed pursuit to create a universal monarchy to restore the Western Roman Empire. This too comes to naught. And what we essentially see is by the 1630s and 40s, Europe is becoming a interstate system, right? What was formerly a very decentralized area of lordly fiefdoms and aristocratic factions have given way to centralized territorial states overseen by absolute monarchs commanding a vast bureaucracy and a vast standing army. And essentially what's coming into being is a kind of proto-modern geopolitical state system, in which people are increasingly taking for granted the Western Roman Empire will never be restored. Rather, some balance of power is going to remain between these territorial states. Nevertheless, that being said, in the early 17th century, no one abandons the goal of restoring Catholicism to all of Europe or spreading Protestantism to all of Europe. And the Thirty Years' War, which takes place between 1618 and 1648, is essentially an effort to reconvert Protestant lands to Catholicism, on one hand, or on the other hand, to spread varieties of Protestantism to Catholic Europe. And so the great territorial monarchies of Western Europe go into the Thirty Years' War with this religious impulse. But the Thirty Years' War drags on forever. It's disastrous. You have to field supply lines all over the continent. And in the case of fielding these supply lines, you have to raise immense resources at home, which means you have to raise taxes on your peasant population. You face revolution and rebellion. There are a whole series of the breakdowns of these territorial states. The revolt of the Cortes in the Spanish Habsburg dominions, the Fronde in Bourbon, France. These things all break out and threaten the dissolution of these territorial states. And so what you see happen in between 1618 and 1648 is a system of territorial royal states that were going to war with one another to spread their varieties of universal faith, essentially empty out in the Treaty of Westphalia, in which they respect one another's rights to exist, with whatever religion the ruler chooses to be the dominant religion in his dominion. So the Treaty of Westphalia essentially says Europe is going to be an interstate system. There will be a French monarchy, centralized monarchy. There will be a Spanish centralized monarchy. There will be an English centralized monarchy. And the monarchs, the sovereigns, will choose the religions. And so the monarchs will choose whether their domains are Protestant, whether their domains are Catholic. This is the shift from wars of religion to reason of state, raison d'etat, in international affairs. The move from a belief in spreading messianic universalist religious impulses to pursuing one's state interests in an anarchic realm of competing states. And it's essentially 1648 where you have the consolidation of the European interstate system based on absolutist old regimes recognizing one another and recognizing each other's rights to set the religion for their domains. Now, an interesting example of this, okay, is that as many of you may know, with the Treaty of Westphalia, the German Empire, the German-speaking Europe, essentially is broken up into many, many principalities, isn't unified, has many different varieties of Protestantism, and of course, Roman Catholicism. So if you look at German-speaking Europe, particularly the Holy Roman Empire, different rulers, some are Calvinists, some are Lutheran, some are Catholics. It's very difficult to imagine a kind of German-speaking confederation emerging out of this mishmash of principalities and archbishoprics with different religions and different rulers. And someone who I currently, Chris used to call you Cardinal Richelieu, right? Richelieu's decision, Richelieu, he cautiously designs this. That is, one of his goals that comes out during the 30 Years' War is to create this kind of system in German-speaking Europe. While at home, he's crushing Protestants.
But
so,
he's aiding the Bethlehem plan that during the 30 Years' War, France, the greatest Catholic power in Western Europe, is actually aiding the Protestants because it fears Habsburg government.
No, it's crushing Protestants at home. It's aiding the Swedish Protestants, Protestants abroad.
Exactly.
That's the key to raison d'etat, though. You want total old regime control at home, so you smash the religious dissenters, but abroad, you promote religious diversity. So he wants German-speaking Europe to be a mishmash of principalities with different religions, but at home he's absolutely pursuing an agenda of Catholic centralization. Okay? Essentially, what's really important to be seen is, if you look at the world of 1648, you have a series of absolutist monarchies, old regimes, now recognizing each other's sovereignty and each other's rights to set their state monopoly religion within their border. Now, in this process, though, they've tended to break down their local aristocracies, their local regions, and they've increasingly created centralized markets. They've increasingly created centralized militaries that allows them to project their power abroad. So even though all this is being undertaken to preserve the old regime, to resolve the crisis of late medieval civilization, what it's bringing into being is increasingly unified territorial markets without customs barriers that can allow goods to flow back and forth within them. What it's bringing into being is standardized and standing militaries that can increasingly project power abroad into colonies and markets. So the absolutist old regime very much sits with one foot in bourgeois society and one foot in the old crisis of feudal civilization. It's the attempt to resolve that crisis, but in resolving that crisis, it reinforces the emergence of the new. And the way Marx and Engels would talk about this is that the absolute monarchies are kind of, they arise because of a balance between the bourgeoisie and the aristocracy. And that's very subsequently badly been understood to be some kind of early Bonapartism. That is, the state can grow powerful essentially because two classes are balanced against one another, the bourgeoisie and the aristocracy. But the problem with all of that is what Marx and Engels genuinely mean is that these things really stand on the edge of bourgeois society, with one foot in bourgeois society. They're creating centralized markets. They're creating the means to have colonial commercial exploitation abroad. They're rationalizing administration. They're destroying feudal privileges and localities. But on the other hand, they're doing it to preserve the monarchy, to reintegrate the aristocracy, to put down peasant rebellions, to pursue their projects of universal monarchy in competition with other monarchies. They have their foot in both worlds very much. Okay? And so while they're drawing on the rising power of the commodity form of labor, of the early lineaments of bourgeois society, while at the same time attempting to preserve the old. Now, I said the 30 Years' War was essentially the consolidation of an interstate system based on old regime states. There's one exception to this, which is the Netherlands, which is a republic, all right? And it is the great exception. In 1648, at the Treaty of Westphalia, the Dutch Republic, the United Provinces of the Netherlands, which are seven provinces of what was known in medieval Europe as the Low Countries, essentially are recognized. And a republic, right, based on the sovereignty of people rather than dynastic allegiance or territorial space, is brought to the world. A new form of political and social order is recognized in Westphalia, although it's definitely a minority. And the Dutch Republic essentially emerges from a period in between 1568 and 1848. Sometimes, 1568 and 1648, known as the 80 Years' War. In the midst of Philip II's efforts to consolidate his absolutist monarchy and to pursue universal monarchy, he begins extracting greater resources from the Low Countries. That is, 18 provinces, seven of which will eventually become the Dutch Republic. And in the context, those provinces, which are the site of extensive proletarianization, extensive commercialization, extensive urbanization, and extensive Protestantization, if you'll forgive that neologism, it's in the site of all these cross-currents of religion, of commercialization, and urbanization, that the attempt to really lock down on these provinces and extract further resources provokes the Dutch Revolt. And the Dutch Revolt, I don't have time to get into the details, I'm already over time, but the Dutch Revolt essentially has many religious elements, but ultimately by 1648, it's a religiously tolerant, liberal, bourgeois democratic republic. And it's the first such republic in world history. And it's recognized in 1648. And so even though 1648 appears to be the moment at which the old regime interstate system has finally resolved the crisis of medieval civilization, what's happened is it's recognized the Dutch Republic. And the Dutch Republic was based on the self-conscious revolt of the Third Estate in the seven provinces that become in the seven provinces of the Low Countries against feudal social and political hierarchies. What do I mean by that? Well, let me just talk about, we are now then entering the world, 1568 to 1648, we're entering the final phase, 1600 to 1848, the emergence of bourgeois society, bourgeois revolutions as political constitution of capital. Okay? We're entering that world in the Netherlands, beginning of 1568, but being fully achieved by 1648, is largely urban-based plebeians and urban-based middling sort. A member of the tripartite caste of those who work, the workers. And remember, very wealthy merchants and very poor artisans and journeymen are both understood as part of the same caste in late medieval Europe, those who work. They carry out a successful rebellion against those who pray. They smash the monopoly of the Catholic Church and the clerical estate, and they carry out a successful revolution against those who fight, principally the Spanish Habsburg monarchy under Philip II and his lieutenants. And in doing so, in those 80 years, they become an increasingly self-conscious bourgeois democratic republic that enunciate principles of popular sovereignty and religious toleration. It is the most religiously tolerant place the world has ever seen by the 1640s, with a real flourishing of religion, ideas, and a freedom of the press and association. And so a bourgeois democracy has come onto existence, which has sort of sent ripples. And which, what's key about this is it's the revolt of the Netherlands, which is the Achilles heel in Philip II's attempt to create a universal monarchy. It's also the revolt of the Netherlands that is the Achilles heel of Louis XIV's attempt in the 17th century to become the sole master of Europe. In other words, in the aftermath of 1648, the country most likely to destroy the interstate system, to overwhelm the balance of power, is Bourbon France, Louis XIV's France. And it is the Netherlands that holds that project at bay. Just as they prevented Philip II's Habsburg monarchy from bringing about universal monarchy, just as they forced their recognition in the Treaty of Westphalia, they, in the second half of the 17th century, hold Louis XIV's marauding armies at bay and stave off a great absolutist power that threatens to control all of Europe and to subject all of Europe to royal absolutism. They're able to do so on the immense resources they generate from the generalization of commodity production exchange, from religious toleration. There are many great studies of many of the great inventors and merchants of Southern, Eastern, Western, Northern Europe moved to the Netherlands during its revolt because it's a place that tolerates diversity of religions, moved there because it's a place where there are commercial access and opportunities. And so it becomes this kind of refuge, safety house, for all of these religious dissidents, scientific dissidents, inventors. And it's able to tap on that genius of invention, that genius of entrepreneurship, and that genius of religious toleration to essentially generate the resources to hold Philip II at bay and to prevent Louis XIV from destroying the balance of power and conquering Europe.
Was it already controlling the slave trade at that point? Or?
It's a key player in the slave trade, but I would not say it's controlling the slave trade at that point, but it's definitely become a key player. Now, that being said, what's so important about this? Well, with the Dutch Revolt, we have entered the actual period of the emergence of bourgeois society. That is, on the basis of the dissolution of grand society, and this is key, the Dutch Revolt was not driven by the bourgeoisie. The Dutch Revolt was driven by the Third Estate. It was as much plebeians as it was merchants and manufacturers and lawyers who drove the revolt against Spanish rule. And they did not understand themselves to be bringing into power the bourgeoisie. Rather, they understood themselves to be unleashing the Third Estate. So again, the Dutch Revolt is the first time that the Third Estate has successfully launched a political revolution against the First and the Second Estate. And in doing so, has made the Third Estate socially and politically dominant. Now, what's important about that is this, is that in doing so, they essentially give rise to bourgeois society, which will be the society of the bourgeoisie and the proletariat. What that means, and this is really, really, really important, okay, is that bourgeois revolutions are not driven by the bourgeoisie. Rather, bourgeois revolutions are driven by the Third Estate, who understand, however wealthy or poor they are, that they all have a commonality of those who labor and those who work against those who fight and pray and rule. And in defeating those people and fully constituting bourgeois society, they set loose the dynamic that will eventually lead the Third Estate to become the bourgeoisie and the proletariat. But urban burghers and urban plebeians go arm in arm into the Dutch Revolt and into all of the classic bourgeois revolutions together against priestcraft, aristocracy, and monarchy. And back to Laurie's crucial question, what separates bourgeois society from what I'm calling the emergence of the commodity form of labor? This is what separates it. Essentially, people who are already beginning to experience liberation from traditional civilization, people who are already beginning to experience their individuality, their separation from custom and caste-based forms of social organization, they enter onto these revolutions in order to deepen and strengthen that experience. So, some aspects of the commodity form of labor are the necessary precondition for bourgeois revolutions. But the commodity form of labor is the fundamental form of social mediation and is only universalized and generalized with the success of the bourgeois revolutions. But the bourgeois revolutions are not class revolts. They are historical, epochal revolutions by which the Third Estate declares itself free from the First and the Second and the absolute monarchy, and in doing so, grasp on to the elements of the commodity form of labor that have already emerged, but generalizes them and universalizes them, deepens and strengthens them. Their goal is to make exchange value the principle of society. Their goal is to make the production of goods and services and their exchange with other people for their goods and services in equal amounts the fundamental value of society. And in constituting politically those bourgeois societies, they set loose the emergence of modern capital that will result in the crisis of the emergence of bourgeoisie and proletariat. But that's really key. The bourgeois revolutions are revolts of the Third Estate that essentially have as their precondition the breakdown of traditional agrarian civilization, the emergence of some elements of the commodity form of labor. But then it is Third Estates grasping on to those new experiences of freedom, those new experiences of entrepreneurship, those new experiences of individuality and universality, to completely overthrow the caste and custom-based medieval world and reorient social life on the principles of exchange. And in doing so, they politically consolidate bourgeois society and set in train the emergence of capital, of modern capitalism. Final point I'll say on this, and then I just have two more points to make, is that, in other words, quite seriously, although I've kind of beat this to death, the rise of the bourgeoisie as a class is actually an indication, all right? The rise of a commercial and industrial bourgeoisie is an indication of prior victories of bourgeois revolutions. That is, the bourgeoisie does not bring about social emancipation, but its spread and growth and increasing social power is an indication of prior social emancipation. It is bourgeois revolutions that create the bourgeoisie. It is not the bourgeoisie that creates bourgeois revolutions. It is human beings seeking to free themselves from feudal bondage and caste and custom-based forms of organization and bringing into being a deepening and shrinking commercial and manufacturing society that ultimately create the social universe that generates the bourgeoisie. And so societies with greater, more powerful bourgeoisies are societies that have experienced political and social revolutions have experienced social and political emancipation. So the bourgeoisie doesn't bring about emancipation. It's a symptom, an index of emancipation. All right? And I'm going to take, because we're going to move to questions, but I just want to say one thing. The Dutch revolt essentially holds Louis XIV that day. What happens in the intervening period is that England essentially is an area of even deeper proletarianization and commercialization and urbanization in the Netherlands. Initially, it's not. But during the 16th and 17th century, the wage labor form becomes far more generalized in the English countryside, begins spreading to English commercial ports and manufacturing cities, and it becomes really the dominant form of social life for about 40% of the population. Now, for 40% of the population to essentially reproduce themselves in commodity production exchange is historically unprecedented. So England is the most deeply proletarianized, and because of that, subsequently most deeply urbanized and commercialized society in the late 17th and 18th centuries. And England experiences the Civil Wars and the Glorious Revolution, which is essentially about a parliamentary supremacy that is wedded to free association and exchange and the growth of commercial manufacturing society coming into being in the defeat of the absolute monarchy. What I'm going to do next time, all right, because next time, even though I'm supposed to start in 1750, I'm going to give this precursor that will go back to essentially, because it's very hard to understand the 18th century without more details on the English Civil Wars, the English Commonwealth, and the Glorious Revolution. So what I will do next time, I'm trying to bring you up to the cusp of the 18th century, the epoch of the bourgeois revolution of 1600 to 1848. And essentially what I'm going to do next time is, I'll start in 1750, but I'm going to work backwards to the mid-17th century bourgeois revolution in England. I'm going to start with the Civil Wars and the Glorious Revolution, and then take it up through the American and French revolutions. But that's really key to understand. The Netherlands is the first bourgeois revolution. It brings into being the first form, fully politically constituted bourgeois society. That opens up a space in which England, which is experiencing even greater levels of proletarianization and interdependency, consolidates a bourgeois state much more powerful and much more dynamic than the Netherlands. And in the wake of 1688, the English bourgeois state is not simply going to hold the great agrarian absolutist monarchies of Europe and the world at bay as the Dutch Republic did. It's going to send shockwaves through them. And those shockwaves are not just going to be felt in Versailles and Vienna. They're going to be felt in Allahabad. They're going to be felt in Java. They're going to be felt all over the Asian, African, and American universe, as much as the European universe. Okay? And so I'll pick up there next time. And the final, I promise, final note, because also next time I'm going to pick up with the English Civil Wars and the Glorious Revolution. I'm also going to pick up with the Enlightenment. But I want you to think about one last thing, this is my final thing, is essentially the Enlightenment, right? it achieves a kind of radical turning point in 1750, but it had been developing for approximately 75 years beforehand. I would argue that although Bacon and Hobbes and others are key precursors, it's really Descartes that is the dawn of the Enlightenment, because it's Descartes who rejects all dogma, and who essentially says in the middle of the 17th century, we can accept no authority, no custom. We must, on the basis of our own reason, our own self-grounded reason, come to explain the world to ourselves. And that is really the moment of Enlightenment. But I just want you to think about how Descartes is in this immense world of upheaval. This world that is breaking down theologically, that is breaking down socially, that is breaking down economically, and that is being reconstituted socially, economically, culturally. It's in that world that Descartes steps out amidst all these revolutions in astronomy, in the middle of the 17th century, all these revolutions in astronomy, in physics, in science, in politics, in economics, in diplomacy, in geopolitics, that Descartes says the fundamental question of Enlightenment, which is how do we know what we claim to know? And how do we do so without assuming any variety of authority, custom, tradition, but doing it solely on the basis of reason alone? And although Descartes does not finish that project, he's the fundamental precondition of all the people we're reading this course, Rousseau, Kant, Hegel, onward. And so I'll end there, and I'm really sorry we didn't go to the early 18th century, we ended kind of in the late 17th century, but I will pick up next time, and I will stay within bounds next time. Very sorry. Richard.
Thank you for objections.
Sorry?
One thing I want to say, and the Hegel quote symbolizes it, I think that part of this narrative, which we had, you have to address the question of the construction of the category called the Middle Ages. And the Middle Ages, as a category, is part of the construction of modernity. It's a way that the early modern understood itself. It goes back to the question about Greece and Rome, and the idea that there's this dark night in the Middle Ages. Now, the Middle Ages is really three quite different periods. There's the European Dark Ages, which seen from a global perspective is a local phenomenon of no great significance, because most of the large parts of the world, agrarian settled states, were not dark at all. The Islamic Caliphate, Byzantium, Tang China, etc. The second of all, you have the High Middle Ages, which is listed here. And then you have the crisis of medieval civilization. Now, I think that the High Middle Ages, in terms of feudalism as a category, you have to understand the High Middle Ages is an incredibly dynamic period. And I think that there has been a tendency to underestimate, from the standpoint of the early modern, the extent to which certain phenomena are rooted in this period. So you have a doubling from 1000 to 1300 of the European population. You probably have more technical progress during those three centuries than you do during the whole of classical antiquity. Because the early modern wanted to see itself in terms of a revival of Greece and Rome, and because of the general issue in terms of the way the religious character of this period, and the sense that religion as the opponent of civilization and the need for a secularization of a worldview in the modern period, I think that there's a tendency to see this and this sort of high point of feudal civilization as relatively static, which I would argue against. I would say it's an incredibly dynamic period, which in many ways lays the groundwork for other things. The other point I would like to make, and this is a broader question that involves a general platypus discourse, is that the fundamental problem in discussing pre-modernity, that many, many aspects of modern civilization are culturally rooted in the pre-modern. It's not as though capitalism begins the cultural world anew. And in this historiography, I mean, I would like to bring up, like, in addition to this idea of, like, the High Middle Ages not being the same, I'd also like to bring up, like, this notion that Karl Jaspers has put forward of an axial age from, like, 800 BC to 200 BC, where you see many different revolutions in sort of a perspective. You have the rise of philosophy in ancient Greece. You have the birth of various world religions that dominate the world, Judaism, and then its later offshoots of Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, Chinese philosophy, and a very large part of sort of a pre-modern cultural or even the modern cultural inheritance of the world goes back to this period. So I think that there's a tendency to sort of compact a lot of these earlier periods, and also, particularly in the narrative, which is easy to internalize, to imagine that, again, this notion of the Middle Ages as the dark period and the sort of the Renaissance as the dawn. So I just wanted to defend the honor of... For example, in this question of the rediscovery of antiquity, I mean, the extent to which certain aspects of antiquity were already highly appreciated in the 12th century is very clear. So I would, again, disagree with this narrative in any respect. I think it's not so much that necessarily many classical authors were rediscovered, and I think you find that Plato is perhaps a more significant rediscovery in many respects than various poets, that it's a way in which a self-image of the human was rediscovered. It's not that people just suddenly saw the text and changed the way they perceived the world. It's that people had been transformed internally and they read certain books differently. So much.
Can I just say one note to this, which is on this category of the pre-modern, I agree with your central point about that. That is, the pre-modern is inherently negative category. It's purely retrospective. That is, obviously, people in Paraguay and Athens and medieval China did not understand themselves as inhabiting a pre-modern world. They share. There's immense diversity between all these societies. Retrospectively, pre-modern comes about as a category of modernity to essentially try and specify the dynamics that separate modern society apart from those that came before it, and in turn to define those that came before it by the absence of those dynamics. So I believe that pre-modern is, as you say, a profoundly negative category. And as such, it definitely has a tendency to downplay distinctions and periods within pre-modernity. Nevertheless, that all being said, if we're talking about, which I thought I tried to make very explicit, the emergence and consolidation of bourgeois society, and it's nevertheless the case that the 12th century, right, is a far less dynamic century of change than the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries. That strikes me as simply indisputable. And it is the case, as I tried to make clear, that in comparison to the Dark Ages that came before it, it's a period of remarkable stability, cereal cultivation, agrarian growth, some cities rising up, a real cultural flourishing. But it is not on the levels of what is broadly construed as the early modern period. It's certainly vastly superior to the Dark Ages that came before it and the crisis of medieval civilization that followed after. That being said, I would, of course, say that you would have to look at the specifics of the 12th century, the high Middle Ages, and talk about certain authors being recovered and other authors being recovered. That's absolutely the case. But I hate to say this, but I would justify how I characterize it by reference to the totality. But if we were just talking about the 12th century, I think that I've put it in a straitjacket that's completely inadequate to it. But nevertheless, in the span of 10,000 years of history, that is principally devoted towards why did, at one particular time, in one particular place, a form of social life that is now global, that is now universal, come into being, which is always the great problem of the West. Right? Which is, how does one understand the emergence of the universal in a particular time and place? And what I mean by the emergence of the universal is the emergence of bourgeois society, which is the emergence of a peculiar way of humans interacting with one another and interacting with nature that completely transforms every aspect of this worldly existence. And if you're talking about it from that perspective, and then you have to retrospectively look back at the rest of history, I think the 12th century has received its more than its fair.
Okay, but what I wanted to say, and I think it goes to the problem of modernity, is that the West, I would argue, is a category that begins in the high Middle Ages. There's a long period in which the West as a category exists until you move to the full flourishing of Western society, which is a product at the end of the 18th century. And it's that sort of long intermediate period, which is being largely described here, which the reason this matters politically, and I want to emphasize why this matters, is that we actually, with the regression of Marxism, live in an era that can be imagined as a clash of cultures. And therefore, like one of the paradoxes of of the regression of politics in our time is that pre-modernity appears to acquire a renewed lease on life. So that if we live in a world where, for example, it seems like the West and Islam are at war with each other, which I would argue is a pseudo-appearance, that in itself brings like this whole period into like a different imaginary that we have to think about. That's the content. And there's a tendency in platypus, because of the sense that culture is a reactionary category, which you can see very strongly in Chris Cutrone, to, I think, not address sufficiently the problem of the totality of culture and the totality of human history, which I know that James isn't trying to do here. He's presenting like the question of the origin of capitalism and bourgeois society. But bourgeois society and capitalism occur within a broader world historical area of this problem of culture. And it's a problem that now, in the present, has acquired a renewed salience because certain types of universalist ideology seem to have disintegrated through political repression. That may sound obscure, but do you understand what I'm saying?
The question is, how this point, because I really do think that the crux here is the transformation that happened between 1300 and 1600. At least, like, that's what James had set up to define kind of what you have an issue with. But I want to know how does this kind of like point that you just made distort this moment of the emergence of capital? How we understand the moment of the emergence of capital? Because I really do think that that's like what we need to walk away feeling more clear about.
Okay, because when you talk about the emergence of capital, James is talking about several processes that are going on, and which are the precursors to the rise of modern life. One is the emergence of capitalism. One is the emergence of bourgeois society. But then when you talk about problems like the Enlightenment, when you talk about the fact that people are not merely economic actors, but live in mental worlds, those mental worlds have a prehistory that goes back into pre-capitalist society. It's wrong, I think, therefore, to dismiss the vast cultural inheritance of pre-modernity in terms of its psychological and cultural role in the categories of thinking in which modernity emerges. It's not just that the commodity form develops through some sort of accidental form, and then out of that comes a new type of way of thinking that poses the problem of human freedom. If you're thinking about this in terms of the problem of human freedom, the problem of human emancipation, and the way human beings think of themselves as human beings, then the problem is not just the rise of a particular form of society. Because if that were the case, then it wouldn't explain why in the Renaissance or the French Revolution people turn back to an imagination of classical antiquity. Because what happened is, not that obviously classical antiquity and the society of the Renaissance, or even more the society of 18th century France, were obviously sociologically radically different. But certain aspects of classical antiquity, which were on a totally different sociological basis, gave people the psychological and intellectual freedom to think about themselves in a different way. That that's not a purely economic process. And there are many aspects of this process in terms of the Enlightenment that are not
Richard, I don't think anyone did say it was an economic process.
No,
I think there is a claim, though, that Descartes, like, for instance, the Descartes' gesture, you might say it's a gesture, certainly, like, Descartes studied Aristotle and Plato, but Descartes' gesture to say that classical learning and the church are actually neither of them sufficient to ground the claims of the modern subject or modern knowledge, that even God himself I can only come to through my sense of self. That is a profoundly different moment, and not, it at least represents some sort of a break from even, you know, the high period of whatever, like, heretical Catholic philosophy in the 12th century, etc.
Are you arguing against the notion of a break?
No, I'm not arguing against the notion of a break. What I'm arguing against is that I think that there were, first of all, I think that there are several breaks. And I think that again, like what I'm worried about is the internalization, and I think that this has been a problem, not just with a certain type of Marxist competition. I worry about a kind of Marxification of a kind of Whig intellectual narrative, and I particularly
Whiggish.
Whiggish intellectual narrative. I don't think that sort of the notion sort of the rise of modernity and the Enlightenment, just as the story of the rise of a sort of progressive secularization of knowledge and the rise of modern science. I think that it's actually more complicated. I think that there are aspects of the way certain types of early modernity needed to see the immediate precursors of that. I mean, this is taking the argument somewhat afield. I think, for example, that the need to, at least in the first phase of modernity, to downplay the significance of the Middle Ages, which had been the more immediate precursor of this transformation, and to look towards classical antiquity, I think that speaks to deep psychological and spiritual needs. But I think that stepping back from it from several centuries, one has to sort of question that narrative. I'm not trying to put forward some kind of postmodern narrative. I'm not trying to say that the Middle Ages never ended. I'm trying to say that the narrative of we awoke from the dark night of the church narrative, but we awoke from the dark night of unreason, the siècle de lumière, that actually ultimately minimizes the complexities of the world in the reason. But I'm probably taking this conversation in ways that
can I ask a different question?
Yeah.
I mean, what I'm not sure I understand is why, in your account, the Third Estate ends up getting politicized in the way it does. So, for instance, I mean, a lot of the actors.
Yeah.
Oh,
I'm sorry, I have to go.
Bye, Richard. Is that what he has to say?
A lot of the actors in. At the moment of the bourgeois revolutions have existed before. So in ancient Greece and ancient Rome, like there were proletarians, like there were people who sold their labor for wages of some kind. They were like in 1600 not central to the mode of production, but they existed. There were some of those. There were also great commercial sectors, great commercial centers, cities, merchants. Those, that merchandise largely was exchanged with luxury goods meant to give frippery to lords, but that's largely still the case in, 1650. So all these actors, there are peasants, so, all these actors have sort of made an appearance at other times in history. But it seems to me your claim, which is right, is that sort of the mutual politicization as sort of like those who work has never really occurred before in sort of human history in the same way. I guess my question is
bring about a new form, fundamentally new social politics,
exactly,
rather than renegotiating the terms of their services.
The question for me is, well, why would that be? Especially if one says that commodity form of labor is not very central at all to social reproduction. It's kind of interspersed here and there, that commercial society is still quite largely at the service, at the service of lords and luxury trading in goods. Why? What is qualitatively different such that there would be a politicization of all these actors together in some sort of new project and not just some sort of attempt to reproduce the old?
That's an excellent question. And it would tie in a way I didn't add. It comes out of the fact that I think probably as it deal with the details of Laura's question, which was why are you differentiating between the period of the emergence of bourgeois society and the rise of the commodity form of labor?
Not that I'm questioning it.
No,
I
know you're questioning
it. It will help.
No, a detail. Well, so let me try and set this up in a detail. I'll try to get in, but as usual, I irresponsibly have two.
Don't be surprised when he adds an extra fourth lecture. I'm just going to say.
No, I notorious this for not for being irresponsible, like in going over time. So okay, so here would be the argument. If you look, if I were to go back into the details, and this is actually a key question of medieval civilization in the 14th and 15th centuries, what you would see is, so medieval Europe had a propensity, as peasants are getting free from serfdom, and they're going into some cities, they're setting up self-governing urban communities, right? As that's happening, what essentially begins to happen is you do actually see the rise in, for instance, Hanseatic League Germany, in Italian city-states, in the Low Countries, places like Antwerp, you begin to see the rise of serious nodal points of commodity production exchange. That is, in cities, in Italian-speaking Europe, German-speaking Europe, Dutch and Flemish-speaking Europe, you see people coming in and being employed in wage labor in production for expansive international markets. Now, what tends to happen is that the countryside remains dominated by the caste form of social organization, namely feudalism. So what happens is there are ultimately definite limits to the amount of people that can go off the land, because many of people are tied, bound to serfdom on the land. Furthermore, feudalism is not an economically dynamic form of agricultural development, so it has a limit on the amount of food that can be produced to support people off the land. So the feudalism on the countryside, even though we see, really from the 11th and 12th centuries, we see some pockets of urbanized Europe become places of commodity production exchange. They're tiny islands in vast agrarian swaths of the feudal countryside, which puts limits on their market, because ultimately you have to sell to the mass consumer society, and you don't have it, because these people are oriented towards subsistence production, they're bonded to the land. It puts limits on the amount of people who can live off the land, because feudal agriculture cannot produce a surplus to allow a sufficient amount of people to live off the land, right? And so this provides a necessary check to the expansion of, let's call it the capital wage labor form in these urban centers outwards. But what happens in the 14th and 15th century uniquely is that it's the countryside that breaks down. And I didn't specify that. It was unspecified in the lecture I forgot to, because I didn't have time. But if you look, what's so peculiar about Northwestern Europe is that first time large swaths of the countryside is broken. That is, I just very vaguely referred to direct producers being divorced from their means of subsistence and also being freed from serfdom. Mm-hmm. I should have specified countryside. So what happens, particularly in the Netherlands and in England, is you get capitalist agriculture. That is, serfdom ends in the countryside, but the lords and the gentry are able to get private property in the land. And that sets in a process whereby the lords and the gentry sell their land to capitalist tenant farmers, who in turn employ these landless peasants to work as agrarian wage laborers and to produce agrarian commodities for sale in increasingly mass markets. That gives rise to a vast expansion of the agricultural surplus, thus allowing for more people to live off the land in cities, because capitalist agriculture is incredibly dynamic, produces a huge surplus. Furthermore, it cheapens the cost of raw materials and necessities, so there are a lot of people running around with more disposable income, which means they can buy goods that they never dreamed of buying before. And so you can get in new urban centers, new industries, and new commercial goods that had only ever been oriented towards lords, now being oriented towards a mass market. And this is a dynamic interplay of essentially the process we're going to see in Smith 2 weeks from now. Right? In other words, Smith's absolutely right. The fundamental dynamic of early capitalism, that is pre-industrial manufacturing commercial capital, is the extension of the market leads to the expansion of division labor, the expansion of digital labor leads to the extension of the market. If we look through human history, though, after the Neolithic Revolution, settled agriculture has provided a break on the ability to do that. And what happens, because late medieval Europe, apologies to Richard, I'm not just doing that because it's not your apologies to Richard, because it's such a crisis-ridden backwater in the 14th century, right? Essentially, you have for the first time the breakdown of caste and custom-based forms of social organization in the countryside, allowing now for these few nodal points of commodity production exchange in urban centers. Actually, I wouldn't even think of it as these nodal points then get expanded into capitalism, because if you actually look,
it's actually different.
Capitalist agriculture is much more dynamic than, in other words, we see forms of wage labor and capital in like 14th century Italy, 14th century Flanders. But they're nowhere near as dynamic as capitalist agriculture. You have these vast factories in the field, these huge capitalist agrarian estates, in which a lord who's claimed private property as land is renting out to a tenant farmer who's in turn investing capital stock and employing agrarian wage laborers, and they're producing for a mass market, and they're producing cheaply, so that mass market has more disposable income to buy other things. And this sets in train exactly what you just said, new cities. So if we look at England, you see a decline of the old medieval textile cities of raw woolen production. But you see Manchester and Birmingham, even though they're nowhere near as big as they'll be in the early 19th century, they're already gaining population by the late 17th century because they're producing new industrial commercial goods. So ultimately, the answer to your question is, how does this make a difference? Well, what actually happens is, I'll just speak to the Netherlands. What happens in the Netherlands, because the Netherlands is one of the really rich zones in northwestern Europe where pre-capitalist agriculture is broken down, it allows for a continuously, infinitely expanding commodity production change in the cities. That, in turn, I would say, really transforms the social life of the cities. Cities rise up that are really, or old cities transform, or new cities rise up that are beyond the old guild structures. People with a lot of disposable income can go in a coffee house and buy a new luxury product they can never afford before. In that coffee house, they can hear newspapers read to them. People, middling sort of people who used to just have a plot of land in the origins of subsistence, now they're exchangers in the market, and they want to know about, where's this war that's going to interfere with my trade here? Where is this harvest failure, which I can speculate on stock there? And they want information, and these become sites of information and interaction. And essentially, you see this commercial interdependency building this rich urban public sphere based on abstract individuals. That is, individuals completely freed from extra economic bonds of dependence and coercion, coming together to exchange equal values of their own possession as the action of their own free will. And it's that social world, as Marx famously says in The Bridges, it is the exchange of values of equal position on the basis of the exchanger's free will that ultimately generates abstract notions of equality and liberty. And so
that's
exactly the
answer to my question. I was there.
Okay.
The question of exchange becoming the new form of value that actually becomes consolidated politically.
Yes. So the Dutch Revolt, and I should have said that, I'm sorry. The Dutch Revolt and the English Civil Wars and Glorious Revolution are the first territorial states that actually embody abstract principles of liberty, body, or semi-term.
But isn't it true that, so take the English Revolution, that actually the, you know, those who one would expect to be the biggest bearers of exchange, like, say, commercial agents of various kinds, merchants, say, and even Marx recognized were actually quite conservative in the English Revolution. So,
sorry, were we talking 1688 or Civil Wars?
Yeah, the Civil Wars.
The English Civil Wars, no, that's a good point in the sense that they become conservative in the process of the revolt of the 1100s and so on. No, that's absolutely a good point. Yeah. But it is nevertheless the case that, and I won't even pretend to be an expert on this, that landed elites in England decided to, so the Stuarts, and we'll cover this next time, I'm sorry guys, but the Stuarts are building this massive standing army to try and have an absolute state. Landed elites in England take a very peculiar action, which they say, the king has the monopoly of violence. He's building a standing army that's let him rule without parliament. And they decide, we're going to mobilize the urban masses in London and the provincial cities against the king. And in doing so, they certainly open a Pandora's box from which they're horrified.
I think that really should be where we live the beginning of the next session.
I will, but,
why
do they do that? But that's the question. Why are they willing to open the Pandora's box and not mobilizing the urban women's sort of poor in a way that, in the Fronde, none of the French aristocrats are really willing to, you know. But I'm sorry, I've gone off the deep end, but that's the basic principle. Is there any, Alex?
My question is about the Third Estate and the revolutions of this Third Estate. And in what sense were they aware of they are bringing in a new world in one sense? Like, or were they trying to somehow go back to antiquity or restore some kind of previous harmony and equality? Or were they completely self-aware of...
Or should they respond to, like, their...
Yeah, like, to what extent would you say the Third Estate was a self-conscious revolt?
I would say this. In the case of the Dutch Revolt, which is 80 years, and the case of the English Civil Wars, which I try to cover a little bit today, which is 20 years. It is not self-conscious, but it is increasingly self-conscious as it goes along. An example of this would be this. The parliamentary landed elite in the Civil Wars, in order to defeat the monarchy, increasingly have to rely on the financial and commercial acumen resources of the London Midland Sort. And in doing so, the London Midland Sort increasingly, who had never been a political nation, had never been formally consulted by King, Court, or Parliament, increasingly begin acting in the world and feeling their own power in the world. And we can see through that process that although they simply started as one wing of people completely deferential to the landed elite, by 10 years into it, they saw their goal as the constitution of a commercial republic capable of securing colonial plantations and marketplaces abroad and reforming administrative in terms of efficiency and low taxation at home, and increasingly bringing Midland Sorts into power. So I would say that the revolution themselves, the actual political event of the revolution, the crisis and catastrophe, because revolutions break out because of breakdowns of old regimes. But it's the process of revolution that brings into being sort of new institutions, new practices, new forms of consciousness that in turn begin to become sort of increasingly organized and self-aware. And really, I don't think there's any plot by commercial or plebeian elements to encourage Parliament to carry out a war against the king in the English Civil Wars, but in the experience of their own self-activity, in driving the war against the king, in defeating the king, in trying the king, in providing the resources, the manpower, the work, the money, the acumen, the entrepreneurship to do that, they come to see their own self-activity dominating social and political life and transforming social and political life. And they begin to imagine a world in which that's routine and standard. But it's only through the process of the revolution itself that happens. It's not at the outset of the revolution. I do think the Dutch Revolt is initially about saying, hey, King Philip, all these new taxes you're leveling, all this new attempt to destroy Protestantism and to reassert Catholicism. In other words, they've had Calvinism for some time, and they've had low taxes for some time. This is very much an attempt to preserve the old. But in the face of doing that, right, they operate as the third estate. They're not trying to overturn the first and second estate or the absolute monarchy. But in the experience of doing that, right, they essentially come to say, we're not simply renegotiating the status of our being the third estate. We're rather constituting a new form of social political organization in which there are no estates. There are only freely exchanging individuals. And value has become the highest principle of social life, which makes all people equal and is regulated by abstract laws that it's indifferent to where you're born, what you're born in, who your mother is, et cetera, et cetera. You know.
Shall we close on that?
Yes. But I'm really sorry that we didn't go to the 18th century. I'm really sorry. I promise you there will only be three lectures. It just
no, I'm fine. The thing is that I'm already seeing that how this sets up a question of what we even mean by postmodern revolution. Because, of course, yeah.
Well, that honestly, to be honest, that's the one I plan to address. I mean, I could, you may not be satisfied, but I plan to directly address it in the ceremony. The second lecture is really the crux. And now it's especially the crux because we ended in 1650. So.